Hey, it's Sally Helm here. The other day, I did something we do all the time here at Planet Money. I called up an expert to help me understand something. In this case, I called a fundraising expert, Paul Edwards, because I wanted to know, how do you ask people for money? Have you raised billions of dollars in your life?
Organizations that I help in the campaigns that they engage me have indeed raised billions of dollars.
Paul's been doing this for decades, helping universities, other organizations raise money. And I asked him how I might get you, our dear listener, to support our journalism by going to donate.npr.org/planetmoney. And he told me about this theory of fundraising that has to do with a hierarchy of questions. He says you gotta know what different questions do, and you gotta be able to use them all. At the lower end,
there are questions which we might call them closed-ended questions. Yes, no.
Those focus the conversation.
But there are questions which are which, who, where, when, and they're a little higher up on the level.
Those will get people thinking about their lives, maybe even feeling some feelings. And then there are the most complex emotional questions of all.
At the top of the hierarchy are why questions.
Why do you listen to Planet Money? Think about it, and then maybe go to donate.npr.org/planetmoney.
There's something happening in China right now that revolves around one particular company, and it tells us so much about the current trade fight with China.
We've been following this so closely, and yet we are still confused.
So we called up NPR's Shanghai correspondent, Rob Schmitz, in the middle of the night to help us figure this out.
So Rob, it's the morning there. You've just gotten in.
It is morning here.
I had to dial you about five times. I dialed the same thing over and over.
All right. Well, fifth time's a charm, I guess.
We called Rob because of this story that starts at the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina, on December 1st.
The leaders of the largest 20 economies on the planet, the group of 20, the G20, get together to work out differences. And it is a huge international summit.
Trump and China's leader, Xi Jinping, are sitting across from each other, ready to talk trade war. Remember all the back and forth tariffs on pork and steel?
I was paying attention to the bourbon and the motorcycles.
Okay, that trade war.
So Rob's in China and he's following it.
I'm looking at all the news wires. I'm getting reports from other NPR reporters who are there. And then suddenly the meeting is over. And the first thing I see is a statement from the Chinese government saying there is a truce.
Did people kiss in the streets?
No, nobody was kissing in the streets. I think people were kind of scratching their heads. I think that's what that was.
Okay, almost as good.
The White House and China agreed to hold off on any new tariffs for 90 days while they try to reach a compromise.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, something is happening that is putting the trade truce in danger.
On that very day, on December 1st, a woman is changing planes in Vancouver, Canada, and she is arrested by Canadian authorities and detained. And this is the chief financial officer of Huawei, one of China's largest and most important companies.
Huawei is an enormous company in China, the largest telecom equipment company in the world. It sells more phones than Apple.
And the woman who was arrested, Meng Wanzhou, is not just the chief financial officer of the company. She is the daughter of the founder.
This is like if Bill Gates' daughter was arrested.
And Canada has arrested her on behalf of the United States.
And at first, no one really seems to know why she was arrested. The Canadians won't say, which is weird. They're usually so nice.
I'm surprised they didn't apologize, too. So what are people saying? Like, in China, what is the coverage like? Does this seem like a big deal? Like,
yeah, it was huge. The Chinese state media had a difficult time not seeing this as a politically motivated arrest.
So this immediately felt like Trump doing something to China.
Absolutely. It felt like the United States was taking a very high profile Chinese executive hostage as part of a plan to put leverage on China during the trade talks.
It looked to China like a hostage.
A prisoner of the trade war.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I am Brian Erstadt.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Rob Schmitz.
Shanghai correspondent.
I'm sorry. And I'm Rob Schmitz. What am I?
Who are you?
Sorry. It's early here. I'll do that again. And I'm Rob Schmitz, Shanghai correspondent for National Public Radio.
Today on the show, the story of Huawei. It's the story of the rise of China and their experiment with capitalism.
we trace a series of events that started on one day in three cities, Buenos Aires, Beijing, and Vancouver.
It is a global standoff with major implications.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from E-Trade. You want to invest your money, but there's one problem. You're not sure where to begin. Luckily, there's E-Trade. E-Trade simplifies investing without the financial jargon. Plus, their easy-to-use platform keeps you in the know about your money at all times. And if you need a hand at any point, E-Trade's investment professionals are standing by to help. For more information, visit etrade.com/NPR. E-Trade Securities, LLC. Member FINRA, SIPC.
Looking for the perfect gift for the public radio and podcast nerds in your life? NPR t-shirts, caps, totes, mugs, pet products, toys, and puzzles are just waiting to be checked off your holiday shopping list at shop.npr.org.
At the heart of this story is a company called Huawei. They make cell phones. They make routers. They make equipment for cell towers. They are developing networks so good, they are 5G.
Not 4G, like what we have.
They went one better.
But you don't really see Huawei phones in the U.S. because the government doesn't want us to have them. Cell phone providers don't offer Huawei phones.
And this company explains so much about our current fight with China and even the story of capitalism in China. And it was started by one guy, Ren Zhengfei.
Ren Zhengfei was born in the poorest province in China, and he was born there in 1944, just before communists took over China. He ended up going to a very good school for engineering, and then he joined China's army, what's known as the People's Liberation Army, or the PLA.
So how does he go from a communist army to founding Huawei?
He's discharged, and he moves to Shenzhen. Shenzhen at the time was this new economic zone that was being set up that would operate differently from the rest of China, in that companies, you could have privatized companies and these companies could compete with each other. They weren't just all state companies.
This is around 1980. China sets aside a little chunk of the country near Hong Kong, draws a line around it and says, okay, go try capitalism here.
It's called the Shenzhen Special Economic Zone, and it is a huge part of Chinese economic history. It's one of the first turns away from communism, one of those like pivotal moments that changed the next 40 years. And Ren is there from the beginning.
And so he goes there, and he raises around 21,000 renminbi. At the time, that's around $2,000, and starts his company called Huawei.
And Huawei grows and grows. It's one of the companies that turns China into the second largest economy in the world. And it is a perfect symbol of everything that China wants to be.
High tech, innovation, fancy campus.
It is a beautiful and very bizarre campus. There are different parts of the campus that are in different architectural styles. For example, one of the main buildings looks like the White House.
Wait, what is this? A tribute to America?
I think you'd have to ask Ren Zhengfei, who does not talk to the press. But at the time that it was built, this campus, I think that the United States was aspirational. And at that time, a lot of different buildings in China were made to look like well-known buildings in the United States.
It just feels like an awkward building to have in the middle of your campus while your daughter's under arrest.
Yeah. But back then, you know, I don't think, you know, when Huawei established this campus, you know, the relationship between the U.S. and China was fine.
Which is so poignant. They literally have the White House in the middle of the campus. China wanted to learn from the U.S. And that's what this experiment was all about. And the U.S. wanted China to grow.
The U.S. was like, we fought communism for years. We want you to turn to capitalism. We think it'll make you turn to democracy and into an ally.
But what's happened in China is different. More capitalism has not brought democracy. And China is only kind of our ally and more our rival.
And yes, technically Huawei is a private company, but in China, nothing is really a private company exactly the way it is in the United States. Huawei, like most large companies in the country, has to have a Chinese Communist Party committee inside the company.
So members of the U.S. Congress are a little worried about Huawei, this massive company growing faster than any other company, and making all of this telecommunications equipment, why they might be under the thumb of the Communist Party, even though they're private.
And so in 2012, Congress says no company that's employing Huawei technology should work with the U.S. government.
In October of that year, the U.S. Congress issued a blistering bipartisan report that accused Huawei and its competitor in China, ZTE, of being arms of the Chinese government. They also accused them of stealing intellectual property from American companies, and they accused them of having the potential to spy on Americans with their equipment.
Congress is worried that Huawei is a straight-up front for the Chinese government, that if America builds cell towers using Huawei technology, the Chinese government will use them to spy on maybe everything in America.
And that's why you don't see much of Huawei stuff in the United States.
But there is still the rest of the world. Huawei is huge in Africa, Europe, the Middle East. It's in 170 countries.
Including Iran.
And here is where we get back to the arrest of Meng. According to U.S. authorities, Meng had done business with Iran while they were under sanctions about 10 years ago. And based on that, this past summer, the U.S. issued a warrant for her.
Now, the warrant was not made public, but the U.S. told Canada, if she visits, arrest her and send her to us.
So when Meng gets off of Cathay Pacific Flight 838 in Vancouver on December 1st, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are there waiting for her.
And the Mounties are there on behalf of the United States. And this is on the same day that Trump is sitting down across from China's president. So Trump and Xi are sitting at this table. Meanwhile, the daughter of the founder of the second largest company in China is being arrested. Did Trump know?
From what John Bolton told NPR in his exclusive interview with us, President Trump did not know.
John Bolton is Trump's national security advisor, a real hawk on China.
Bolton himself said that he himself knew about it, but that the president did not know this.
The arrest becomes public, and the Chinese press goes wild. They say the United States are resorting to despicable hooliganism. And China threatens Canada with grave consequences if Meng is not freed immediately.
And no one knows exactly what this means.
But everyone is pretty sure it is going to affect the trade war.
So Meng is sitting in a Canadian jail, and prosecutors are like, we can't let her go on bail. She has all the money in the world. She's just going to get on a plane and leave. They argue about this in court.
Her defense team says, look, she's got health problems. She has hypertension. She's not a flight risk. And plus, if she did escape custody in Canada and go back to China, this would mean that she would lose face for herself, for her father, for her company, and for China. And then the defense lawyer proceeded to explain the concept of face to the judge and to the court. I think a lot of China watchers had a collective eye roll in response to this, because oftentimes, you know, this type of thing, the idea that the Chinese are so mystically different from the rest of the world and that only the Chinese would understand this is commonly used as a defense.
Meng puts up around $10 million Canadian dollars to be let out on house arrest. She gets an ankle bracelet, and she is now paying for her own surveillance at her fancy house in Vancouver. Canada will decide later whether or not to turn her over to the U.S.
And as soon as she's put under house arrest, we start to see some of those grave consequences. And they're real. On December 11th, China takes Michael Kovrig, a former Canadian diplomat, into custody. And it looks exactly like retaliation for Meng's arrest. And for good measure, they take another Canadian into custody, Michael Spavor. You going to take one? We're going to take two.
That's a message that the Chinese would understand immediately, because this is exactly how China's authoritarian government operates.
The United States doesn't really arrest random people or hand over prisoners when they're trying to settle trade disputes. But President Trump recently told Reuters that he would intervene in Meng's case if it would help trade negotiations.
People went ballistic. The criminal justice system in the United States is totally not supposed to be a tool of the president.
Definitely not a trade negotiating tool.
It runs counter to
everything. Yeah.
I can't. How much of this is just the inevitable clash between two giant economies, and how much is this two people, Xi and the president?
I think it's bigger than two personalities. I think that Xi Jinping is the face of a certain part of China that was always there, but he's just bringing it out more.
And this is not how China's former leaders, like Deng Xiaoping, used to handle things.
You know, China for a long time operated under this maxim that was coined by former leader Deng Xiaoping, and that was to hide your strength and bide your time. Hide and bide, which means basically don't let other countries see how far you've come and what you're capable of doing, because it gives too much away. And Xi Jinping operates by a completely different principle. He wants to show the world that China is a force to be reckoned with and that China is actually a guiding model of what a country can be.
That model is authoritarian, state-controlled capitalism. Capitalism with censorship and restrictions on freedoms.
And the problem now is that there are two enormous countries that both want to be the guiding model for what a country can be. Meng Wanzhou and two Canadians so far are trapped in the middle.
This message comes from NPR sponsor State Farm. State Farm isn't just here to help home and auto insurance go right. They're here to help with things like life insurance, too. So let State Farm help protect the life you've always dreamed of. State Farm, here to help life go right.
Hey, it's Sally again. Remember, our expert fundraiser at the top of the show told me if I want to ask for money, I should practice using different kinds of questions. I'm going to try it out. We'll know if it's working if you go to donate.npr.org/planetmoney. Okay. Do you listen to Planet Money? I know you do. Where do you listen to Planet Money? Picture that place. Why is Planet Money in your life? Support the show by supporting your local public radio station. Donate.npr.org/planetmoney.
Got a hot tip on an emerging geopolitical standoff? Email us, planetmoney@npr.org.
Today's show was produced by Darian Woods and Sally Helm.
Special thanks to Echo Wong. Planet Money's supervising producer is Alex Goldmark. I'm Brian Terstad.
I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I am definitely Rob Schmitz. At least, I think I am.
Thanks for listening. I feel like we should just Google and make sure something else hasn't happened, because literally, as every time I sit down, something...
It's a good bet something's happened in the hour that we've been speaking.